with a kind of a landmark paper in muscle wasting and critical illness. And this paper was by a group out of London, Puth and Carey. And they looked at what's happening to the muscle during an admission to the ICU. And they looked at three different measures, muscle ultrasound to look at size, and then they looked at muscle biopsies on day 1 and day 7 to look at rates of protein synthesis and protein breakdown, and then they also did some DNA analysis and protein expression. And the two that I really just want to talk about are the ultrasound and the muscle biopsies. And so the patients were admitted to the ICU for acute respiratory failure. They had to the way that the doctors put it is they had to be expected to survive. So they excluded all those that they thought had a high mortality risk. This was just a breakdown of some of the pathways they thought that they were going to try to look at. So I'm not going to go into that, because most of them are the same pathways that we've already learned or other people have talked about. So this first figure here is muscle ultrasound. And you can see on day 0, their baseline, and then they have this steady drop in cross-section area in the rectus femoris. Up to 20% changes in 7 days of muscle loss. So it's pretty significant. On the right there is cross-sectional area by muscle biopsies on day 1 and day 7. There's some changes going on in the fiber cross-sectional area, but it wasn't as significant as we thought. But still, you can see about a 20% change. So when they actually did the biopsies, they used a technique to administer leucine. And so they took a biopsy right before administering the amino acid and then 150 minutes after they had administered the amino acids. And so one of the major limitations of this study is that they did actually infuse amino acids into the muscle, which itself can stimulate protein synthesis. And so they may have been actually stimulating protein synthesis when they were measuring it. And so one of the main key points of this is that protein synthesis didn't change compared to fasted controls, so healthy normals. But, again, I caution that point because they are actually giving leucine to measure it. And so you can see the changes from day 1 to day 7 in the muscle and the fibers. And it's very, very significant in just 7 days. So it's happening really, really rapidly. I didn't want to spend too much time on the paper because we only have 15 minutes, but I thought this picture was really, really awesome. And it kind of sets up what I really, really want to talk about. So, I'm going to back out of that. So I am a physical therapist, and I initially got into therapy for sports, like most people do. But after my first job, I started to really, really develop a passion for patients with critical illness. They go through this traumatic event and they develop just severe, severe deficits. And one of my goals is to figure out what's going on and are there interventions that we can do. I won't let me present. Oh, well. Just go from here. So my dissertation project is muscular dysfunction and functional analysis outcomes in patients with critical illness. I really want to focus on the clinical aspect. I also want to do the basic science, but part of our issues with the IRB, it's going to be really hard to get muscle biopsies approved in this population. A lot of them are sedated and intubated, so you have to have a LOR or a next of kin give consent. And in this critical time period, day 1, day 2, there's a lot of issues with obtaining consent to get biopsies. The second point is that at UK, our critical illness team isn't ready to quite take on that challenge of how do we get them to approve and how do we get the IRB to let us do it. And so really I'm just going to be focused on the clinical aspect. So a little bit what I've been talking about is that these patients suffer severe deficits in function, weakness, strength, cognitive, emotional, that lasts their entire life. That bottom point there, about half will never return to work, and an even higher percentage won't return to the same level of work, so they'll have a different job or they won't work as often. a lot of them will be dependent on care from a caregiver. And so what happens is a family member usually becomes that caregiver. And now we're losing wages from not only the patient, but also family members. And it's a big issue. Survivorship is one of the key kind of burdens on healthcare in the 21st century. And so, as physical therapists, we have limited tools to diagnose what is going on with this muscle weakness, muscle impairments. The current diagnosis is done by the MRC scale, which is a test of muscle strength through manual muscle testing. You get a score out of 60, 12 muscles out of 5. There are major, major limitations with this. The first one being that to judge between a 4 and a 5 for a physical therapist is really hard and really subjective. And so there's a lot of the intra and inter-rater reliability. This is really, really low. The second and the biggest point of why I'm really focusing on my topic is that the patient has to be able to engage. And so that initial time point from day 1 to day 7 to day 10 when they're still intubated and sedated, this can't be performed. And so we're missing that initial point of diagnosing weakness. So our primary hypothesis is that even though those tools exist, there are other tools that are out there that we are able to use to classify these patients. And so we can start to put them into groups to determine who would most benefit from early progressive physical therapy or occupational therapy. And also to try to help us determine if there are phenotypes of patients. And what I mean by phenotype is that are there groups of patients that they're not going to respond to physical therapy anyway, so why are we wasting our resources on them? Or there is this group that really, really would benefit. Why don't we focus more heavily on them? And so to test this hypothesis, we're going to look at muscle ultrasound, muscular power, which I'm going to talk about a little later on, and try to predict and see if we can predict those people that would have the greatest changes in muscle. Our target population is the 3 or 4 ICUs at UK, primarily the medicine ICU. That's where a lot of the acute respiratory failure patients are going. But we also want to look at across the ICU, are there changes in the target population? We'll exclude anybody with a neurologic condition, pre-existing, or stroke. And we also want to exclude those patients that were non-ambulatory before, just due to issues with measurements in the ultrasound and the power. So the first aim really is to focus on muscle ultrasound. And so in Puth and Carey's, he showed that 20% change. But we want to confirm that in our patients, and then we want to start to correlate those changes to functional outcomes. Functional outcomes are what we use as physical therapists, so it's important that we connect those two points to really show that we can, as physical therapists, use those outcomes to track changes in muscle weakness. These are just the methods. I'm not going to go through them. They're similar to Puth and Carey's. From the ultrasound, we can get cross-sectional area, and we get this grayscale. And this grayscale has been validated against muscle strength and muscle biopsy for muscle quality, so to speak. Muscle quality in that it can detect changes in the fibers. And so if there is necrosis or fatty infiltrate, we can start to quantify that through an ultrasound. Functional outcomes we're going to use, there's going to be a whole battery of them. This is an issue, another issue that I'm not going to talk about, but basically we have so many outcomes and different therapists use different outcomes, and so it's hard to compare when people do studies. And so recently there's been this core establishment of functional outcomes, and these are the main four that they've said to use. So the second point is really becomes the novelty of this, the innovation in my dissertation is muscular power. And power has been tracked in performance and geriatric population, but it's never been looked at in critical illness. And as a therapist, one of my main critiques is that when we're training these people early on in the ICU, we really focus on activity tolerance. We really work on endurance and getting these people up. But we never really focus on training muscular power. We do resistance exercises, but they're really just range of motion. We're not really training strength. And so I wanted to see what I hypothesized, that muscular power is probably dropping similar to the size and strength. And so that's the goal of this aim. You can see that in this geriatric population, they use a linear potentiometer, and that linear potentiometer will track how fast she sits the stand. And so that will give you the velocity of the motion. Through some mathematical equations and talking to some of the experts and talking to Dr. Butterfield, we can then calculate power, but it's not as specific as it would be if we were doing single fiber. But it's the best we can do in humans, especially in this population. So that's one that I want to mimic here in that population. Again, they have to engage, so it's a later time point, but this is the first for tracking power. The other three will be supine, and so in the bed, if they are able to engage, we're going to start that power tracking, and we'll use the same technique, a linear potentiometer, to track the velocity. Some people in the sports world use IMUs, which also will give you velocity, and so we'll look at that as well to see which one is more specific. So as I said, this is really where the novelty of my dissertation comes in, because it's not been done in the critical illness population. We're using modified techniques from performance and geriatrics that have been shown to have good reliability and validity. And so hopefully we can modify our techniques and really use it in ICU. The innate challenge of using it in ICU, though, is it's critical population. There's intubations and lines and tubes and in the bed, and it's just a different environment. And so the last point here is that we'll take these measurements and we'll see if we can develop a prediction model that will help physical therapists start to group these patients into phenotypes that then we can then say that need or don't need early interventions. This is some of the methods for the statistics, so I'm not really going to go into it today. The last point, the significance, with some pictures of people in our ICU as well as people in our Australian ICU, is that we want to really establish the relationship between functional outcomes, muscle size, quality, and power. And so that therapists have those tools and that they understand what's going on in the muscle and not just functionally. One of the main limitations of that is that it is correlative. It's a correlation and not a causation. So we are establishing the relationship, but there's some weakness in the methods. And then again, to determine if ultrasound and muscular power can be utilized early in the course to classify those patients. The big impact here is hopefully what I hope is that there is a culture shift and that we're no longer working on just activity tolerance, but we're starting to train power. And what I mean by that is instead of just having them sit to stand, we're actually cueing them to sit to stand as fast as they can to really start to do it repetitive and really work on functional tasks that will make them more independent when they discharge or when they go home. That's it. Yes.
So you have multiple different illnesses represented in your ICU patients, right? Your subjects are going to be different. So will you stratify between the folks perhaps that have trauma versus cardiac, because I can see the muscle function being different?
Yeah, our goal is to get 120 in my power analysis to get a R-squared value of 0.25, which is a really, really low R-squared value. We need somewhere around 39. And so hopefully we can get about 30 to 40 in each ICU. And so that's why I said 120. We're only doing it in ICU. They're quick measurements. And so feasibility-wise, if the power measurement is quick and easy, that's the one that's going to determine if it's feasible or not. But I don't see any reason there can't be. Our ICUs are, the medicine ICU has 54 beds, and they are always full. So if that gives you an idea, we have the patient population here at UK. Yeah, Dave.
So is your functional outcome HP?
One of them is, because it's an important one, because it really detects.
No, it's super.
Fall risk, function, you know, all those major things.
I guess, you had the short physical performance battery on there?
Yeah.
And you had just the Gatesby under it, or you're not doing the whole test?
No, we are. The issue with the short performance physical battery is that it has a floor effect in our ICU patients. And so on the other tests, most likely they'll score a zero. But we can still get the gait speed. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. But even a score of zero or one is really predictive in the SPB. You know, it's still a score.
That yeah.
And then so is the idea that, so like you'll get SPB score or gait speed, and then you want to see if strength or muscle power predicts performance in those more effectively?
Exactly. ICU and hospital discharge.
And I'm sure
we'll have a lot of missing functional tests if we do look at ICU discharge, because some of them won't be able to do it.
Yeah. Are you, when you do your power test, that's a sit-to-stand test. Is that going to be done while they're doing the sit-to-stand at the SPCB, or it's two separate tests?
It'll be two separate tests. And there are other power measurements, too, that we're looking at that are supine. So, yes, to answer that question.
I guess it's helpful. I haven't really ever thought about this, but it would be interesting, I think you just want to be careful to standardize how they're getting in and out of a chair. The SPPB has a really specific way to do it.
I'm familiar.
And then if you take time to completion and then you're taking someone's body mass, is that like a quasi power output measure?
Yeah, that's one of the issues with the methods that we're going to work out is it actually power if we're just getting velocity and how do we standardize the load? Because you're right, the body mass is going to be different.
Yeah, they're moving their mass, so you need to normalize for that.
Yeah. And we talked about using, a force plate transducer, the portable one. And so when they sit to stand, they're actually engaging the force plate. Because they do have a portable one in the KHP department. There's issues with that too. And then in the supine one, so one would be upper extremities are really, really important for functioning in these patients. So feeding themselves and starting to engage. And they do that really early on. So I'm thinking that one of the really, really important ones will be just a simple elbow flexion, because that's kind of hand to mouth. If we can get the weight standardized, a 2-pound weight that everybody uses regardless, and then measure the velocity, that might be the most important power measurement we take. Yeah.
You could normalize to the lever arm as well. So for the upper extremity, you probably would be able to do it for lower extremity too. That way you have at least a normalization factor that you can off of. But you have to take joint angle for your distance measurement.
Yeah. Yeah, we've talked about that. We talked about, is there a device that we can make that would standardize it across the board? That way we don't have to worry about it. Tim has some ideas for that.
Like, no one does upper body, it's all lower. But unless you're reading a biomechanics journal, no one's talking about joint angle.
Yeah, I hadn't seen it either, but that was something that Alexis mentioned too. I don't know. It's a good thought.
You want to get into a biomechanics journal?
No, I don't. In the journals that I'm targeting, this is going to be like the first paper. Power has not been looked at in critical care. So, how we define it, how we look at it, if our methods are standardized, it's really going to be kind of up to.
The gold standard in major research is like double leg press.
No, but we talked about maybe a shuttle press that has some, that's portable and it has, I forget, but it basically has springs and a pulley and then you can set that.
You can do that.
And they're only $90. I looked at them. But then it's a different muscle group, which is fine. It's just a muscle group that we can't really do standardized with ultrasound. So if you're doing a shuttle press, it's more glute, hamstring, kind of pushing, and so to get that in an ultrasound hasn't been done.
What about the knee extension?
That's one that Dr. Butterfield and I have talked about, and he has some ideas to take an old CPM and kind of
that would be awesome.
retrofit it with a linear potentiometer and a standard weight. And so the issue with that is then I have to carry it to each patient each time and set it up. And so if it's, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, yeah. All great ideas, Davis. Like, yeah, and we've, that's the issue. There are limitations.
My comment, I guess, more than a question, is that you talked about changing kind of the dogma of ICU, early movement and functional, and everything you're doing is super novel, and I think it's amazing, but
it's not
with the fabrication of these devices, only you in this ICU would be able to do it. So maybe trying to correlate some of what you find to measures that people in other ICUs can use, especially if one of your aims is to try and generalize some of these findings.
Yeah.
Fabricated devices sometimes make things a little bit tricky in that area.
And I think that's where the short performance physical battery could play a role, if we can correlate what's happening to their power with the SPPV, which is part of AIM-3. You're right that just because I measure power doesn't mean that they're going to change the culture. And so there is a next step, and that next step would be, should we do a training regimen that's activity tolerance in group one? Group two is power training. Group three is kind of the control, the usual care, and see which group, you know, has better outcomes. And so you're exactly right that it is a dissertation project and more time sensitive, and so I'm not doing an intervention-based study.
It sets you up, though.
But the next study would definitely, you know, look at, hopefully, what you all have both mentioned. And if I can get muscle biopsies on top of it, game over. Yeah. I can just retire.
You've already retired.
I mean, it's the same trajectory, muscle power and aging. You know, John Bean published a paper in the late 90s that showed the partial R of power was a predictor of functional outcome that in China alone.
Yeah, no. I've seen that paper too. Yeah, and so there's a lot of headway to be made in that kind of realm because it's no one's looking at it. And when I talk to national meetings, no one's even has an idea of how to do it in ICU.
Your biggest barrier is going to be also patient education, especially when family members are making the decisions for these people.
Get the consent.
Just having them understand why you're doing this and the benefit of determining this information, because we have barriers to patient participation with healthy people, relatively healthy people, whereas your patient population...
It's going to be a challenge. Do we have time for Joel?
Joel's going to go first on Wednesday.
Okay, I was saying we only have 7 minutes.
Thanks, so. Kirby.
Sorry,
you're welcome. I kept it short, but the questions were...
That's good.
Good discussion. Good. When I have to stop.
No, and I appreciate the thoughts on power because it's not a...
It's not as black and white when you...
No, and it's not an area that I am well-versed in. I'm a clinician, so I don't...
It's very good.
Thank you very much.
Should we log off?
Yes.
I'm just curious.